You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 457. Neither Redbox nor Netflix are even on the radar in terms of competition. Blockbuster CEO Jim Keys.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's film, B-I-Z, book.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. So guys, this week we're going back in time. We are going back to a time where video stores reigned supreme. And the king of all video stores was, of course, Blockbuster. And today's guest is a filmmaker who had the opportunity to direct a documentary about the last Blockbuster on the planet. His name is Taylor Morden, and his film's called The Last Blockbuster. Now, many of you in the tribe know that I, in my high school days, worked at a mom-and-pop video store, and I have just a nostalgia for video stores and VHS and all things 80s and 90s in general. But the story of Blockbuster and how they were brought down and how Netflix took them over and that they had a chance to buy them at $50 million back in the day and they refused and all this kind of myth. Well, this documentary actually breaks all that down. It wasn't Netflix that actually brought down Blockbuster. They didn't help the situation, but they weren't the main cause of it. And we're going to get deep into that in this conversation. But what is even more ironic is that The Last Blockbuster is a runaway hit on Netflix. It just got released on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, please jump on Netflix and watch it because it is a great, great little film. But we're going to get into all of that. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Taylor Morden. I'd like to welcome to the show Taylor Morden, man. How you doing, Taylor?
Doing great, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, man. You by far have the coolest backdrop of anybody I've recorded with, Ben. Very nicely art directed, sir.
It was my COVID art project was just keep upping the Zoom call background over and over again.
I mean,
I look back at old interviews of me and there's different backgrounds every time. It's come a long way.
No, I have to ask, that is the video from Hollywood Video, right? In the background?
Yeah. Yeah. I had the old neon sign.
How'd you get that?
And there was a couple selling it on Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace or something. And I saw, and they had the Hollywood Video sign, but the word Hollywood is like 50 feet long, you know, and 12 feet tall.
Right.
So I asked him, you know, can I buy just the word video? And it was an old neon sign. So I had to like take it apart. It had been sitting in the dirt and clean it and do all this and then converted it to LED and hung it on my wall.
God, man, that's a different level of cool, sir.
It's a different level of nerdy. I think you're saying nerdy wrong.
Nerdy. Look, man, I got a Yoda behind me, so, you know, I'm not too far behind you, sir. So before we get started, man, and go down the nostalgia road that is video stores and Blockbuster and your amazing documentary, how did you become a filmmaker? Why did you want to become a filmmaker?
Yeah, I in the 90s, I'm aging myself a little bit. When I was a kid in high school, the school had a VHS camcorder, like the big, you know, put it up on your shoulder, uses full-size VHS tapes. And that was my first introduction to video. We never, you know, could afford a video camera at home or anything like that. So I would check it out from the school. It was a very small school. So they would know, like, oh, if the video camera's out, Taylor's got it. And I would do all my projects, you know, school projects. If I could get out of writing a 5-page report by doing a 5-minute video, I did that all through high school. And I loved it and, you know, kind of got the bug. And my senior year, the school invested in Premiere 1.0. And we had some kind of video capture card where you had to plug the VCR into the computer.
An RCA capture card.
And it would capture at like 320 resolution, 320 by one, whatever that ratio is for 4x3, you know. It was bad. And then I kind of got out of it after high school, but I loved it. I did a ton of like little goofy videos with my friends. Kind of got out of it after high school because I was more into music. I was playing in bands. I wanted to be like a rock star and tour the world, put out albums and do all that. And I did. And I was always a little involved in our music videos. You know, that was like, oh, yeah, that's right. I do love video. And then after college, I got my job was Flash animator. I got a digital arts degree and I was doing those Flash intros on websites that you couldn't skip that everybody hated.
So for people listening, I need to stop you there for a second because you are a Macromedia Flash.
Before it
was Adobe. So it's Macromedia Flash. You got a degree in Flash. So you got a degree in multimedia production / Flash. Money well spent, I think, for long term. It was definitely a long tail. It's essentially me getting a degree in VHS repair.
Yes, which was a degree at the time that you could have got.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just had to point that out. Continue.
No. You're very much correct. And then, you know, around 2010, 2011. Apple killed Flash. Basically, they just said, we're not going to support it on our iPhones and iPads. And then the whole internet went, okay, well, we're not going to use it anymore. And it was gone. And so also at that time, video was taking the place of that. You know, broadband was everywhere and you could put a video on a website instead of a Flash animation. So, and DSLRs were getting to the point where even a struggling musician like me could afford one that could do a decent job. I had the Canon T2i and it did okay looking video with the 50mm 1.8 lens that everybody had. Mm-hmm. And I started just doing video work with that, like commercials and weddings and just anything you could point a camera at. Real estate, I shot real estate for a while. And I did that for a while and I made a decent living as a videographer in Washington, D.C., and then I moved back here to Oregon 6 years ago, and all that work dried up because it's a small town and there aren't enough weddings and car commercials to keep me afloat. And that's sort of when I decided I wanted to try making documentary movies. I figured I have the skill set. I had a slightly better camera at that time, and I thought maybe I can make a documentary. And basically I asked my wife, is it okay if I spend a year trying to make a movie? Because I'm not going to earn money doing that. And she gave me 1 year. She said, you know, try it, figure out how to do it. And, you know, in a year, if it looks like it's going to make any money, you can keep doing this. Otherwise, go get a job at Best Buy. And it's almost 6 years later and I haven't had to get that job yet.
But the threat is always there.
Always there.
Always hanging over your head. Like, I believe in you, but the clock is ticking.
You go make your movies, but you know, eventually you'll have to get a real job.
Yeah, we'll see. I've been trying to get a real job now for 20 odd years. So So I feel you. Oh no, you can imagine if I tell my dad now or my parents now, they're like, "So what do you do now?" I'm like, "Oh, I talk on the internet. And I've got a podcast." Like, what's a podcast? I'm like,
"Oh man."
I also do movies, and she's like, "What?" And they're like, "Okay, do you live in Los Angeles? You have a house. Apparently, you're doing something. Okay, so go with God."
Right. Well, people either think you're telling me make movies, and they either think you're a millionaire, right? Oh, you make movie. You're a film director,
like Tarantino, like Spielberg,
like Tarantino. Can I borrow $200,000? No, sure. Or if they've ever met a filmmaker, they know you have no money, and they're like, "Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, you're a filmmaker. Oh, that's a shame."
Yeah.
So that's essentially what we get. No, it's always fascinating to meet people outside of the carny world that is filmmaking, because we are carnies. I mean, there's just we're carny folks. You know, we smell of cabbage. We have small hands. sorry. No, that's a reference from Austin Powers. But we are carnies in many ways. The film industry is such a small business, and it's kind of very misunderstood by people outside the business. So they automatically think that you're super wealthy, you're super rich, or you're famous, or this or that. And it's really interesting, especially from the older generation who has no idea. Get a real job. I forgot I was talking to somebody who's a very accomplished screenwriter, and his father was just like, "When are you gonna stop with this writing stuff? When are you gonna actually get a real job?" Like, but dad, I've won an Oscar. Yeah, but a real job, something you could do honest work with. So it's hilarious. Now, I wanted to bring you on the show, man, because you directed this this wonderful documentary called The Last Blockbuster. And many people listening on the show know that I too worked at a video store, not the corporate, horrible corporate juggernaut that was Blockbuster, that just crushed the mom and pops. I worked in one of those mom and pops and only went to Blockbuster when I couldn't find a copy of something. And every time I'd walk in, I'd be like, this is amazing. They got 400 copies of something. But yet I still hated them because they took business away from us. But now I look back at Blockbuster and Hollywood Video, I'm just like, aw. Like, I kind of miss it. But you wrote this, you did this amazing documentary. I got to know, first of all, how did this get started? What did you like? Why did you say, "Hey, Blockbuster, let's do this"?
Well, I loved renting videos since I can remember, since I was a kid. And it was always like a big part of my life. And I loved it. And I would, like, you know, save up my allowance so I could walk down to Hollywood Video or Blockbuster or the local store, ride my bike and rent a VHS and take it home for the weekend and watch it four or five times, that kind of thing. So, you know, I'm of that generation where, I mean, that was a big deal, and I've watched it kind of disappear. And then, like I said, I moved here to Oregon 6 years ago now. And the first week I moved here, right by my house, there was a Blockbuster Video that was going out of business. This was 2015. So, you know, they had recently, corporate had gone away, and I knew Blockbuster Video is going away. There's not really video stores anymore. Netflix is huge. But before even our furniture arrived, you know, we had like shipped it via pods, and I went to this Blockbuster Video that was closing, and I bought all the DVDs and Xbox games and things that were 90% off and, you know, a dollar, and bought all the things and tried to buy the, you know, the Blockbuster sign on the wall, but they wouldn't sell it to me. So I was excited. I was like, "Oh, that's cool that this town that I just moved to had a Blockbuster still. Too bad it closed." And then flash forward about a year, I had been driving around town and I would see another big Blockbuster sign, the big blue ticket that we all know the shape of. And I thought, look at that. They couldn't afford to take the sign down. They just had to leave it up, you know, because it's so expensive. And you see them all over the country. People send me pictures of them now. Oh, once a week, somebody's like, "Did you know there's still a Blockbuster?" I'm like, "Yeah, go inside. Yeah, see what you find."
Mine's is a Petco. It's a giant, new Petco, but they wouldn't take the damn thing down. So it's like a movie ticket with Petco on it. They're like, "I'm not taking that down. That's going to cost you."
Yeah. I don't even, the one in Washington, D.C.
How does it cost to take that down? It must cost a lot of money. It's huge. They're huge.
Right. They're huge. You got to get a crane in there. It's a whole thing. If you've ever had to have a hot tub moved, you know.
What you say in Washington, what?
In Washington, the one near me was a liquor store, but it was the ticket shape. And it was, you know, liquor store video.
Right.
But for some reason, one day I just, my curiosity got the better of me. I wanted to take a picture of the abandoned store for Instagram or something. And I stopped and I went in. And it was like going through a time warp. It was like no one told them Blockbuster had gone out of business. Like they didn't get the memo. I went in and it looked the same. It felt the same. And it smelled the same as I remembered. You know, it was like, oh, it's 1999 and I'm going to rent The Phantom Menace and it's awesome. And the only difference was this was 2017 by this point. And so it was the new Star Wars movie and it was the new Marvel movie where the 200 copies up on the new release wall. So it was very nostalgic, but at the same time exciting of like, wow, what the heck is going on here? Who is still renting movies? Because that was the other thing. It was packed with people renting DVDs.
It's like this weird Back to the Future scene.
Yeah. I couldn't understand what was going on. And so that day I talked to the owner and the manager and said, hey, I'm a filmmaker. I'm doing air quotes for those listening. I'm a filmmaker. Would it be okay if I started bringing cameras around and just like interviewing some customers if they're okay with it? You know, I won't get in your way. I'm just fascinated. And they said, oh, okay, that's weird. No one's really ever tried to, you know, nobody cared at that point. And that was the beginning of it. It's now 4 years later and the movie's just now out. So,
and when you started, there was still, 13 Blockbusters?
12.
So 12 Blockbusters around the country. And then,
the 13th one was the one by my house that closed down.
Right. So it just so happened that you befriended the one Blockbuster that's still in existence. So it just was happenstance that you moved to Oregon and you were close to that one. You could have moved to Alaska.
Right.
Because that one held up for a little while. And that whole John Oliver thing. And I remember John Oliver sent the jockstrap from Cinderella Man or something like that for Russell Crowe's to get people to come in the store. And you know, when we hear like, oh, in Alaska, they've got Blockbusters. I'm like that makes sense. There's probably bad internet there. And you know, it's still a thing and it's smaller towns. I'll buy that.
When we started, we for sure thought the Alaska stores would outlast the Oregon store.
Makes
sense. We had no delusions that this was going to be the last Blockbuster in the whole world. But we still thought it was an interesting story. And we were just like, well, we'll follow this store and see what happens. And we could, there's like nothing we could have done to make it happen the way it did. It was all, you know, documentary filmmaking magic of being in the right place at the right time and making friends with this store before everybody was beating their door down and trying to get the exclusive.
Right. So that you were in already. And well, I forgot the name of the manager and the lady who owns it. What's that?
Sandy.
So Sandy, by the way, when you watch the movie, Sandy's the star. She is the star of the show. She is the heart and soul of that place. She doesn't own it. She just manages it. But the whole thing is run because of her. And she's like ride or die. Like she will not go. She told her husband, like, I am not retiring. I am here as long as this store is open. And I will continue to keep, it's just amazing. So while you got in early in 2015, then I'm sure there was other filmmakers or other news organizations or other that wanted to come in to have that kind of same access. And Sandy's like, no, we're good. We got somebody. We've got this filmmaker who's already doing a documentary on us, and we love him. We love Taylor. Is that basically the way it goes?
That's a little bit how it went. After I was making another movie at the same time, which pro tip, don't do that. But I was making two documentaries at once, and I brought on a partner for the Blockbuster doc who had a little bit more Hollywood experience than me. He was a writer for years on Dexter's Laboratory, Powerpuff Girls, bunch of kids shows in the 90s and stuff. And he was very smart. He early on was like, hey, let's just get a little contract in place for the life rights for this story, just in case it blows up. And I think we would have been fine without it, but it was In hindsight, it was a great idea.
What a great suggestion.
Yeah. So if you're starting a documentary on something that you think might blow up, that's a great tip, is just get something in writing that says you're the only one who can make a movie about this.
Yeah, they could do news stories and all that stuff.
Yeah, they did a ton of news stuff, but anything that was longer, even short form stuff, they would run it by us. So Sandy would call and say, I don't know, this kid wants to do a short documentary for their college thing. Is that okay? And then we would talk to the kid and be like, what's this for? Is it, you know, wow. You're not going to turn it into a feature, are you?
We don't want to have to sue. That's awesome, man. That's amazing. I don't know if I might have mentioned this to you once. Or I know I mentioned it on the show once. But my when the video stores were all going out of business, Hollywood Video was the big one that kept going out of business around me, and I figured out to go in and buy some old videos, DVDs, and then I would sell them on Amazon. And I did them a little bit here and a little bit there. I made a little extra cash, and it was when you could still sell DVDs and stuff. But then right before we moved to LA, when I had very little savings, we were moving to LA, my wife and I, didn't know anybody, the Hollywood Video around the corner finally put up the going out of business sign. And I walked in and said, can I speak to the manager? What can I do for you, sir? I'm like, I need everybody to leave the store, please. Why? Because I'm going to buy everything you have. And I bought the entire, they're like, fantastic, we can close up early. And I go, do you take Discover? And they go, yes. And I bought, it was just too many. I think 10,000 DVDs and video games. And I spent about 12 grand or something like that on my credit card. And then I told my wife, well, even when we get to LA, if I can't get a job or you can't get a job, at least we can sell DVDs to keep the lights on. And that's what we did. I mean, we fortunately, both of us got jobs right away, and I was off and running. She was off and running. But we must have made 30, 40 grand selling DVD for the next year. For the next year, it was just a slow drip of like DVD sales and video game sales. I had GameCube. Like those old GameCube TV.
Oh, yeah. Little discs.
The little disc. I sold everything. And that was the Hollywood Video. That was the one that went down. But I never did a Blockbuster, because I think Blockbusters were still too solid when I left. Because I left in 08.
Mm-hmm.
In 08.
Yeah, they were still.
Blockbuster was still, but Hollywood Video was having issues. So that's when they went down. So I never did a Blockbuster. They started going out of business. And over here in L.A., when I got here, there were still Blockbusters. I got here in 2008, so there were Blockbusters everywhere.
Yeah. But
then I would, like, as the years go by, I would keep driving by this block. I'm like, how are they still alive? How are they still going? And then that one turned into a Sherman Williams paint store. And then the other one turned into the Petco. And then slowly but surely, there was a couple of video stores left in my area in the Valley. And one of them is still there, but they're like a VHS. They only do VHS. They're still alive. And I think it's just like anytime you see a documentary about nostalgic VHS or they just go there and rent it out for the day. It's
right.
So it's amazing. Now, the one thing I noticed with the last Blockbuster, you've been able to tap into something, a kind of filmmaking I kind of coined, which is nostalgia filmmaking. You're attaching your film to an existing audience that's really all about nostalgia. So all those VHS documentaries, documentaries on, that was that one at HBO about the water theme park that killed people.
Mm-hmm.
That tapped into an 80s nostalgia. I mean, Stranger Things obviously touches it in big time, but you're able to do it. Can you discuss what you were thinking about? Because, I mean, obviously you understand what I'm saying. I mean, it is definitely a nostalgia thing to watch this documentary.
Yeah. No, nostalgia is kind of my brand, if I had one, because I've done – this is my third feature documentary, and all three of them are pretty much rooted in the 90s. And I, as a human, am also pretty much rooted in the 90s. You know, I still love – I collect action figures and VHS tapes and vinyl records, and I'm – you know, I am my target audience, which is a really important thing, I think, as a filmmaker, for anybody, you know, make stuff – if you need to figure out how to get through to an audience, just figure out what you like. And if there's enough other people like you in the world, then you have an audience. And I've done it with all three movies. And the thing that I kind of figured out really early on my first one, when we did Kickstarter to raise the money, is, you know, with Kickstarter, you can raise some money, but you also build a community that is invested in this thing. And you found through the internet now like-minded people. You know, my first movie was way more niche. It was about a single one-hit wonder band called The Refreshments. And there's not a ton of Refreshments fans, but I found them all. And I sent them to the Kickstarter. And then my second movie was a little bit bigger. It was about the music genre ska, right? So No Doubt, Real Big Fish, The Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, a lot more fans. And I found them. And that Kickstarter went bananas. And I still, you know, have the email list, and I'm still pushing those DVDs and trying to get those people, but I'm engaged in that community because I'm also a fan of that thing from that era. And then with Blockbuster, it was the same thing. You know, I grew up loving it. And when I walked into that Blockbuster for the first time, I had that wave of nostalgia that, like I said, that first day was when I asked if we could film there, because I figured if I could capture any of that feeling that I felt going there and then try to sell it to people who are my similar age and have my similar life experiences of those Friday nights at Blockbuster Video, and maybe you get a pizza and, you know, hanging out with your friends and you rent The Matrix and oh my God, and then you watch all the special features and then you watch it again because it's not due back till Monday. Like, that feeling, it's gone in the world now. So being able to tap into that, you know, just from, like, you're getting at the marketing standpoint of, like, how do you, you know, capture this vibe or this nostalgia and then try to sell it to people. I don't think it's that hard. It's people want it. People long for the good times, the good old days that we all remember. I mean, you see it in every, like you said, Stranger Things, in every facet of pop culture. It comes in waves. You know, there's a reboot of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles every 6 years because new kids don't know what it is, but also because the parents are still going to go back and watch it because, oh, I remember Leonardo. That was my favorite, you know?
I mean, Disney is doing very well with that, with the Marvel and the Star Wars franchises.
Yeah, and just reboots in general. Reboots and remakes. It's the world. I'm thankful to be doing, you know, documentaries are different. I'm not just rebooting Short Circuit 2.
But you're tapping
I'm reminding into people why they like the original one.
Right. So, like, you know, you're tapping into those that time. So, like, the documentary series on Netflix, The Movies That Made Us. Which is and The Toys That Made Us, which they like break up, like, you know, to transform, like, an hour about how the Transformers came, or He-Man came, or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came, or like the making of Die Hard, or and they just do it in a very so strategic, nostalgic way. They got me because I watch all of them.
Me too.
Every season. All of it. I just like, yeah, sure, I'll watch the Barbie one too. I don't care. I want to just, right. It's fine. It's part of the series. I got to watch it. But so you figured out at the beginning of your journey as a filmmaker that you need to find your audience and make product for that audience. So you were using the filmtrepreneur method in many ways before you even knew what an entrepreneurial filmmaker was, because you're selling, you're still selling DVDs, you're still selling other products and things that are, and you're still making money off of these old
same kind of thing where I said, if you make stuff for yourself and find other people, right? I love physical media. I am the person who, if I find an indie movie that I like, I'm going to buy the VHS version because that's cool to me. Or, you know, if a band I like puts out an album, I'm going to buy the vinyl record, whether I listen to it on the turntable or not, because that's cool to me. You know, I like movie posters. I like things like that. So it was easy then to think, well, if I like that, maybe the people who like my movie would also like a poster or a hat or a t-shirt, or, you know, if I could make action figures, I would, but it's weird with documentaries.
That would be amazing.
Yeah,
Tiger King would obviously have them.
Right. No, I listened to your book, the Filmtrepreneur book, and I, as it was going through, I'm like, oh yeah, I do that. I do that. I do that. Mm-hmm. I do that. Oh, that's a good idea I haven't tried, but I do that one and I do that. And it all kind of works in different levels, depending on the project too. You know, I've done three of these, and, you know, Blockbuster sells a lot more VHS copies, obviously, than the other ones do.
Right, exactly. And you, I mean, being strategic like that to tap into that nostalgia, and it's something that just keeps going. Those, like, I accidentally made a nostalgia film with On the Corner of Eagle and Desire, which was about, you know, filmmakers at Sundance.
Sure. And now that we can't go to film festivals, like, it's a relic.
I don't think there's going to be a time like it was even a year or two ago at Sundance the same way, when there's 50,000 people jammed into Park City. Like, I don't know if that's ever going to happen again, or if it's going to be complete. I don't think what I was able to capture will be there again. And it wasn't strategic. I can't say, like, yeah, there's a pandemic coming, so I know people. But in many ways, I've made like a Christmas movie, because every year now around Sundance time, people are like, well, I didn't get into Sundance, but at least I could watch Sundance.
Yeah.
You know, watch and be there. It kind of feel like it'd be there. So it was kind of like a weird nostalgia as well.
Unintended nostalgia.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, we didn't get into Sundance as well, but we turned our lemons into lemonade, and we put the rejection letter quote, the one nice thing they said, we put that in our trailer. And actually, our distributor was like, are you sure you can put that in there? We had to prove that Sundance had said it.
Hey, look, I mean, when I've been rejected so many times from Sundance, I've lost count. But early on, I would just say, I would put the laurels on my website for some of my short films, and I would say, officially rejected, really loud, in a Sundance Film Festival. Officially,
hey, rejected. You paid for it.
Can, you know,
yeah.
So it's,
that's a $100 graphic.
Exactly. Well, I tried to get in there early, so it was only 50.
Okay.
So I wasn't the guy that just showed up last minute. That's $125. That's ridiculous. But yeah. Now, one thing I did notice about your film and the music you guys had, like, you had a couple of songs there that I'm like, that can't be cheap. How did you get the rights to Smash Mouth, which is a very –
It's All Star, yeah.
All Star. So All Star is like probably one of the more licensed Smash Mouth songs,
mm-hmm.
that's been in a million big movies, and I can't believe that was cheap. So can you tell us how you got those rights? Because I'm assuming you're not rolling deep enough to drop $150,000 or $200,000 for that needle drop.
Right. Yeah, no, we did not. We did not spend what we were supposed to spend. No, that came from, like I said, my other movie. I was working on two at a time. It's about ska music, and Smash Mouth was part of that scene. So I had approached their guitar player, who is their primary songwriter, to be in that documentary. And he was a cool guy, and we were hanging out, and my producer for Blockbuster was there with me, because to save money, you know, if I'm flying to LA, I'm going to shoot both, you know, interviews for both movies at the same time,
because
it saves me $500 in plane tickets, right? Mm-hmm. So we probably, I think we came from, I can't remember, maybe the Adam Brody shoot or something, and went straight to the Smash Mouth shoot. And so he was there with me. So after we were done talking about ska music, we started talking about home video rentals and Blockbuster Video, and he had some fun takes that actually made it into the movie. So that's pro tip number one, is if you want a hit song, find the person who wrote it and put them in your movie.
Fair enough.
So we reached out when we were doing the music. We thought, wouldn't it be fun if we put a couple needle drops in here that were songs from the 90s, early 2000s that were big in movies that people associate with blockbuster videos subconsciously, right? Like Smash Mouth All-Star was in Shrek, and Shrek was a huge home video hit because kids, you know, every week, can I get it? Can I, you know, it's before you could stream anything. So it was an obvious choice, and we knew the guy. So we reached out and said, hey, can we get this song? You know, is there any way we can get it for free? You know, in music docs, you can get a lot of music for free if you know the right people. And he was like, well, we do own all the rights, but we can't do free, but I can get you the really good friends and family discount. And that knocked it down a ton. I mean, I'm talking like 90% off. And so it was only a couple $1,000s, but we didn't have enough money. And you know, we have no real budget. We're self-funding everything after the Kickstarter money dried up. And, so the way music licensing works is you got to pay for two licenses. You have the publishing and then the master. So the publishing is the songwriter, whoever wrote it, they get paid. And the master is whoever recorded it. So a lot of times it's the same people, right? The Beatles wrote and recorded their own songs. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times somebody else wrote it, so you got to pay two different people. In this case, they own both sides, but they doubled the price. So me being a musician, there's another pro tip for indie filmmakers out there. I just recorded it myself. We did a sound alike. I played all the instruments except the drums. I had my buddy do the drums, and I sang it. I figured I could do a pretty good Smash Mouth impression. I got a gravelly voice. And that's the version in our movie. It's just me doing a cover of Smash Mouth because it was half the price. And we did the same thing. There's another hit song in there, and it was my producer's wife is also a professional singer, and she sang the other song so that it wouldn't, you know, give away our secret. But it's in the credit, so it's not really a secret. But
so that's
All Star, written by Smash Mouth, performed by Taylor Moore.
So that's a really great tip, because even for not even for docs, but for features as well. You can, mm-hmm. If you can get the songwriter to give you the rights at an affordable price, which a lot of times the songwriter will give it to you for an affordable right. It's generally the master, whoever owns the master, which is that mm-hmm. the original recording, that's where the money.
Those are the big record labels, yeah.
And they're not giving.
And then a lot of times they'll do a most favored nations deal where you have to pay the same for both. So even if you can get the publishing, you know, for $1,000, which is cheap. The master holder might want 10 grand and then you have to pay 10 grand for both. So now it's 20 because of the way they work those deals. So it's a slippery slope. But yeah, if you just know somebody, you know, find a local band you like and say, yeah, I'll pay for your studio time. Go record me a version of this song. That's also why you hear so many covers now in movies and in trailers, especially. Like it's always like a cool modern cover of an 80s song. Well, a lot of times it's way cheaper to do that than to get the real song.
And that's another great, great tip. Like again, and you could just find cover bands on YouTube mm-hmm. or on SoundCloud or on Spotify or something like that. I'm like, hey.
In my first movie, I did that. I just found a cover I liked on YouTube, emailed the artist and said, hey, I've got, you know, the songwriter signed off on this. Can I use your cover? And she was so happy to be in a movie. She didn't charge me anything. She's just like, great, put my name in the credits and send me a DVD when it's done.
And
that's pretty common. Yeah.
Pro tip for everyone listening. Now, the other thing that I saw in your movies, and I've always wanted to know about this in documentaries, video clip rights. You cut away to clips that are not specific to, you know, to what, I mean, it is kind of specific to what you're talking about, but it's kind of like a reactionary thing. But it's not like part of a blockbuster documentary. So it's not like a clip from a blockbuster commercial, which we could talk about as well. I know there's limits to that, but like you would cut away to a shot of a film. I forgot which one. It was like Tom Hanks or somebody like that.
We had Apollo 13 in there.
Right. You had an Apollo 13 thing. So you're like, how does that work? Because I'm assuming you didn't call Universal up for that, those rights.
We did not. And I would appreciate it if nobody calls them now. But
they don't know about it. Shh, quiet.
Yeah, that stuff is a little bit over my head as far as the legalese of it. But what you have to do when you're making a documentary is you need a lawyer, unfortunately. And that's on this one. I think it was our biggest budget item, really, was legal fees. because somebody's got to write up those contracts to clear those songs and all those movie clips. And even the things you pay to license, you need all the paperwork done correctly, and contracts and all that. And then you also need somebody for, if you're doing this kind of documentary, something called fair use, which is not like a hard and fast rule. It's an argument. And you need a real lawyer, an entertainment lawyer, to provide you a fair use argument that they stand behind that says, here's why this is considered fair use for this movie, right? So like with Apollo 13, it was because we were telling the story of the Netflix founder who had claimed in an interview that he founded Netflix because of too many late fees from renting Apollo 13. So it's kind of the punchline to that story. We tagged it on Houston, we have a problem, right? It all fits. And there's a couple of arguments there. One is the fair use for context. And then you have to, for the lawyers, you have to tell them we used 7 seconds of the movie. The total movie is 2 hours long. So this is 0.3% of the movie. And we used it, you know, to illustrate this point in this context. Blah, 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 blah. And they put all that together to come up with a fair use argument. A fair use argument for our movie, I think it was like a 50-page document that covers everything. And you take that, and that's what you give to your insurance company to get your E&O insurance, which is what you then take to your distributor. So it's this whole chain of like the lawyer says it's okay, you know, for whatever legal reasons. A lot of times I don't understand the argument, but they're like, well, in this case of, you know, the NFL versus John Smith, it was proven that you can whatever. And it's either I think there's satire, there's educational, and another one, but there's a few different things that you can claim, because it's okay to make fun of someone.
Mm-hmm. And use then, those clips, you know, yeah, and use those.
And use their picture or something like that,
commentary,
so that your audience knows.
Commentary,
commentary.
Yeah, commentary is another thing. Like, if as long as you are actively talking about it, unless the entire, like, I can't just take a movie like Apollo 13 and just do an audio commentary and sell it. That's not doable. Like, there has to be
jokes. Right.
Like that. Like
right. But if you were doing an essay about movies about space and what they got right and what they didn't, you could show a clip that says, oh, they got this right, here's the 10 seconds where they got it right. And so it's all about context. And, you know, like I said, there's a reason these lawyers make more money than I do
right
on these projects.
Well, like, yeah, if you're making a documentary about Ron Howard, I mean, you can show clips of his filmography as people are talking about right his stuff. So mm-hmm there is
it's not a hard fast right. Like, we can still get sued. It's just in these lawyers' opinion, based on other cases in similar situations, we would win. And that's what the insurance company uses to say, okay, we'll give you insurance, because that's who pays the legal fees in the event that whoever, Universal, sues us for 5 seconds of Tom Hanks in our documentary about Blockbuster Video, which I would argue that all movies are fair game because they were all in Blockbuster Video.
To be, that's an argument to be had. But there was that room, okay, was it that movie called Room 237.
Oh, 237, yeah.
Yeah, 237.
The Shining.
Which was the documentary on Kubrick and The Shining. And my God, the entire movie is just wall-to-wall clips from yeah Shining, Eyes Wide
they
Shut.
May have had to get, they may have had to get permission.
I doubt that.
I mean, there is a limit.
I mean, no, but I don't know how they did it, and I might have him on the show soon, so we'll find yeah out. But I want to find out, like, what – how did they get away? Because it's like – and but at the very beginning, they say Warner Brothers does not – this is not approved by them or anything. So there was a big yeah disclaimer, first things that come up. So there has to be a, I don't know what they did, but I want that lawyer. Anyway.
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, you had to deal with 7 seconds. I mean, I can imagine having to deal with a whole movie like that. That's
yeah,
that's,
in my music doc, the ska one, we had a few news clips and music video clips, and music is way more dangerous. There. You know, you're not supposed to use any seconds of any hit songs, but, you know, if it's attached to a music video in the context of talking about music videos being on MTV, it's like borderline okay. But my lawyer on that one, she kept sending me back things and being like, you got to shave 2 seconds off of that clip. You got to make sure the audio doesn't go. You can't do any J cuts or L cuts with fair use clips. That's a fun tip.
Yeah. It has to be just the clip.
Yeah. The audio has to be contained within the video.
You can't have that music kind of fade into another
right,
clip.
Exactly.
Another video clip, because it's like, oh, it's smoother, it's nicer. Yeah, no.
Yeah. So we would record sound alike music that's like in the same vibe, but it's nowhere near the right song, so that it wouldn't have a harsh stop, right? So it could keep going and it would just be like our little lounge music version of the
So what's your distribution plan, and what did you I don't think you self-distributed, right? You actually have a distributor?
Right. So I self-distributed my first two movies, and using filmtrepreneur methods and selling DVDs out of my garage still to this day. And it's great. And I love it. I love the relationship you get with the audience and the control you have over everything. But with this one, you know, Blockbuster Video is such a well-known thing. It's niche, but it's not, right? Like if you go into a room of 10 people and you say, hey, I got a story about Blockbuster Video, 9 of them are going to be interested, because unless they're under 20 years old, they grew up with it and it's been a part of their lives. So we kind of knew early on with this one, and I also have a partner on it who has done more of the traditional route, where we wanted some kind of a traditional, you know, we want a good publicist. We want to get reviewed in the New York Times, and we want to be on all the platforms, you know, because self-releasing, you can only really get on Amazon unless you go through an aggregator. And not, hey, not like
anymore.
I was always,
and by the way, not,
yeah,
anymore.
Not anymore.
Yeah. They stopped right. accepting documentaries, which was, that's a whole other.
Yeah. I had one of mine pulled off of, it was up for Prime in the UK. I was testing out Prime to see, like, everybody says you can make some money on Prime, because I've always only done TVOD on Amazon, which has been great because I can drive the traffic. But I was testing out Prime and they just pulled it yesterday. I got the, and they didn't even tell me. I just logged on and it said, your Prime minutes have gone to zero. And I checked and it says platforms restricted or something. So I'm hoping they don't pull me off TVOD, because, you know, those, my first two movies, they're doing pretty well on TVOD. On Amazon. My thought is, as long as, because they take 50%, as long as they're making money, they have no reason to take my movies down. But no one thought they were going to turn off documentaries for no reason.
They've turned into the evil empire at this point. They, like, you know, their whole Prime was built on the back of independent filmmakers. Like when that's launched, it was crap. And all the only thing that people would, you know, that's why they opened up Amazon Video Direct, because they needed content. And now that they're all hoity and tidy in there and like, oh, we're good now. And now they're like kicking everybody off without any, it's just, anyway, that's a conversation.
Scary.
It's
scary because it is a big percentage of my income.
Right. And I know filmmakers who have lost that whole business model was wrapped around Prime. And all of a sudden now, It's gone. Hence the whole filmtrepreneur method, multiple revenue streams, as many of them that you can control. You selling a DVD, you control that.
Yeah.
That's a revenue stream.
And the same with this. So we did do a traditional distributor. We went with a company called 1091, who used to be part of a company called The Orchard, and they've done a lot of really cool indie releases, like the early Taika Waititi movies and stuff like that. And they're... we kind of liked their vibe. We had talked to a bunch of distributors. And we did get in a little bit of a bidding war of, you know, bouncing deals back and forth. And they beat everybody else's offers. So we went with them because they also sounded like they kind of understood what we were trying to do and how we wanted to market the movie and all that. But we did keep our physical rights and our theatrical rights, which at the time we thought there might be theaters. There aren't, but we were able to do some drive-ins and stuff, which was cool. But physical has been doing well for us as a self-release. You know, we happen to have a retail store, right?
which is two big racks
at Blockbuster Video, which not many filmmakers get. You know, when you make an indie film,
you have an exclusive Blockbuster.
We did. We actually, I looked it up. We had the first Blockbuster exclusive DVD since 2011. And we gave them a 4-month window before it's on, you know, you can buy the DVD on Amazon now, but for 4 months, you could only get it through their website or in their store. And it was a Blockbuster exclusive.
And first and one helps in a them, decade. And it helps them keep them alive too. I'm assuming that's like a great souvenir when people go to visit.
It's a great souvenir. And they, yeah, we're helping a huge chunk of the revenue. We basically split the profit on the DVD with the store. So, you know, it's great for them to have something like that they can sell, because a lot of their customers are tourists and they're not going to rent something, but they will buy, oh, this movie's about this store and I can buy it at this store that I've been to. Wow.
It's actually kind of cool. That you could do that. And I'm assuming those VHS sales are slamming.
So we did partner with like an indie VHS company called Lunch Meat VHS, and they did a limited run of 100 units, and it sold out in 30 minutes. So we're doing another one. You got to keep an eye on our website to know when that's going to launch, because it'll probably sell out in 30 minutes.
So, but the thing is, when you're making VHS, there is no new VHS is being made right now, right? There's no, is there?
Yeah.
There's no company in the world, or at least not in the States, who actually manufacture brand new VHS. Now, there's still a lot of VHS out there still, a ton.
And yeah,
they're old.
I think that's true. I think that's the case.
Are they old schooling and putting a piece of tape on it and recording it?
So I had to. We did a Kickstarter reward of just like limited to 20 units, because I knew I'd have to make them myself, of like the first run of VHS made by the director. And I literally put the tape over the old VHS and recorded it in real time. You know, it takes 2 hours to make a VHS, not to mention the time to print the cover, cut the cover, stuff it in the thing.
Oh, and it's brutal.
And I don't know where you get new clamshell cases. So I went to thrift stores and bought, you know, old movies that were in rental cases. So some of them have like the cool, you know, 3-day rental or, you know, new release stick on the case still. And I figured those are cool limited variants, but for the new ones, they're getting like new VHS from somewhere. Like it's not being taped over something. It's a fresh tape, and they even do them. Ours are in yellow and blue plastic tapes to be the Blockbuster colors, which is really cool.
That's just pure nostalgia. All that is just 100% pure nostalgia. And do you, the other thing, man, was there's this great Twitter account called The Last Blockbuster. I thought it was connected to you. It is not, apparently. And what happened? Have you reached out to them? Have you worked with them at all? Mm-hmm. Because it's a genius account. I mean, the stuff that comes out of that Twitter feed is hilarious.
It's one of the funniest Twitter feeds out there. We don't know who runs it. We reached out to them a few times to be in the movie, to, you know, after it came out, to tweet about the movie. No avail. They didn't seem that interested. My theory, and is probably not true, but my theory is that it's somebody you've heard of, you know, some comedian or somebody who you would know, who doesn't want people to know it's them. Because you never see an interview with the person who runs that Twitter account. But it did help us out a lot when we were reaching out to some of the celebrities to be interviewed in our movie, because people thought we were them, and we didn't correct them right away. You know,
as you shouldn't,
You know, we'd show up like at Ron Funch's house, and we'd say, "All right, let's, you know, get set up and talk about Blockbuster." And he'd be like, "I love your Twitter." And we'd be like, "Thanks." Our Twitter, meanwhile, has 50 followers.
Right. So let's just record. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
sign this release. Thanks.
Exactly.
That's whatever
you gotta do, man.
now it just released a little bit ago that you guys got a big Netflix deal, which is the most ironic thing ever.
Yes.
So how did that come about, man?
Yeah, that was, you know, Netflix is a character in our movie. They're, you know, as much as Blockbuster was a villain, big corporation, when they were on their way down, Netflix was on their way up. So they became sort of the villain in the Blockbuster story. And we always thought, making the movie, we're like, wouldn't it be hilarious if one day our little movie about Blockbuster could end up on Netflix? That would be the icing on the cake. And before we had a distributor, I had a direct contact at Netflix, and we tried to get them, you know, onboard earlier and sell it directly and not go through a distributor, do it the real DIY way. And we were turned down twice by them and by everybody else, Hulu, Amazon, all the, you know, they don't really like direct submissions. It's very difficult to get past gatekeepers and all that. So that is part of the reason we went with a traditional distributor, because A, we get a second chance, you know, be resubmitted by somebody they know, and B, they have a track record. They have movies on Netflix. They have that relationship. And so once we signed with 1091 back last summer and we were working out all these, you know, license deals, they got offers from all the big platforms for us. And we were astonished. We were like, well, that just goes to show you there's a limit to what you can do in a DIY way, because people just won't listen to you, or they don't want to deal with you. They don't want to put a new vendor in their payment system to cut you a check. You know, it's just as simple as it's annoying to work with somebody new. So going through the distributor, they, you know, got us these offers, and Netflix was, I don't even know if it was the best financially, but it was the funniest place for it to end up. And we figured maybe that would get us, you know, on a BuzzFeed article or something. So
a lot of people are going to see it now.
Right. We'll never know how many people, because Netflix, you know, guards their data like it's a pile of gold, and it is. But it's hilarious to me. And, you know, as an indie filmmaker trying to make some kind of career, I feel like I have a movie on Netflix is a good opening line for future conversation.
No, there can be no harm from it, I don't think. From people I've interviewed and spoken to over the years, who, like, if their film gets on Netflix, a lot of people see it. A lot of people will see it for the most part. I mean, it depends on the movie and things like that. But something called The Last Blockbuster on Netflix, I have to believe is going to be a huge hit. And
I hope so. We'll see. It's hilarious either way. So
Sandy's going to be, she's already famous. She's already famous because of you.
She's famous around here for sure. Everybody loves Sandy.
Everybody knows her. Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests, dude. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Oh, today is weird.
Like literally.
Because it's hard.
Weird.
Literally today, with COVID and all that. You know, what I've been doing is just writing stuff and planning for future shoots, because I'm one of those people who's not out there filming. But if it weren't COVID times, I think the advice is to do the thing. Everybody who's starting out now is so much luckier than we were starting out with the VHS cameras and the two VCRs hooked together to try to figure out editing, all that stuff. And now our phones are, you know, 10 times better than anything we ever had. So the advice is just make stuff and don't ask anyone for permission. You know, you'd be surprised what you can already do. I think that's kind of the thing, to go for it.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
So I just recently did my taxes and started doing what people would call real bookkeeping for my business. I'm doing air quotes again. I would say how to deal with the money side of all of it. I'm still bad at it, so it's still something I'm trying to learn. But, you know, I just want to make movies and make art and make music and do all these things. And I've always hated the money side of it. I wish I had started to pay attention to it earlier.
Yeah. You and MC Hammer.
Yeah, me and MC Hammer. Yeah. So that one's taken me quite a while. And my wife doesn't love my inability to keep proper books.
Oh, my wife stopped worrying about that years ago because now she doesn't. So
that's the solution.
Because they just are like, look, I can't hunt and cook. I'm sorry. I can go hunt, but I can't cook as well. So sure. She could be the hunter. I could be the cook. It doesn't matter. Whichever way it is, I want to get into all that. But I, you know, there's certain skill sets that you have as an artist. And I know what my sweet spots are, you want me to start doing accounting and math, you're going to run into trouble. It's just so, and you can afford, I mean, look, a lot of times you, if you're out there listening, a bookkeeper is not that expensive. You know, if you're making some money that you need to keep track of your books, you know, it's not that expensive to hire a bookkeeper to come in every quarter and look things over, hopefully. Yes, taxes.
Well, maybe I'll try that.
Dude,
the worst part about being indie filmmaker is you have to do all of the jobs, right? You don't just get to be a director, a producer, an editor, a colorist, a sound mixer. You do get to do those things, but you have to. But you're also, you know,
marketer,
the driver and the marketer, logistics coordinator,
tax accountant,
chef,
accountant. Like, that's why I tell, that's why I keep telling people so many times on the show is put as many tools into your toolbox as you possibly can, because you're going to need them. Even once you start rolling in the money, once you, you know, you're living the high life, hopefully one day, you're going to, I promise you that you're going to really fall back on those tools, that you've that experience without question. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show. And three of your favorite films of all time.
Well, I'll limit it to one per trilogy to make it fair.
Fair enough.
Because otherwise, you know, all three of them would be so similar. So I'll start with The Empire Strikes Back. I'm a huge Star Wars fan, and it's the best one. So, but most of those movies I really enjoy. I'm one of those, I'll even tolerate the prequels kind of people. But Empire Strikes Back has always been.
We could have a conversation about the prequels if you'd like.
I'm sure we could.
Okay. Wait, let's just stop for a second because I have a Yoda in the back. So I have to talk. Let's talk about this for a second. I went back and watched The Phantom Menace with my daughter the other day. And I'm a huge Star Wars fan. It was not particularly good, but some of the stuff inside of it is legendary. The Darth Maul sequences.
Oh, yeah.
The pod race. Great. I could have done without Jar Jar. I'm sorry. Didn't need Jar Jar. Neeson, awesome. There are elements. Ewan McGregor's Obi-Wan, just no question. And I can't wait for the new series, and it's going to be great.
But there
were sections of the prequels that had, there was moments. But look, there's people who were, that was their trilogy. There was a generation that was their trilogy. Like our generation, our trilogy was the original trilogy.
Yeah.
Other people's was that trilogy. And then there's another generation that it's the new trilogy, like my daughters and the youngins who think that that's like the greatest. And for another generation, it's the Clone Wars and the animated stuff, because there was that long period between.
Oh, yeah.
That there was only.
And then the luckiest generation are the youngest kids now who get introduced through The Mandalorian.
Oh, my God.
And they're imagine. That's their first thing. It's like the best. Can you imagine being that lucky?
To be the intro. Look, I was in the theater and I saw Empire when I was a kid. And I was too young for Star Wars, but I did see Empire. And I remember watching Star Wars for the first time on a black and white 7-inch TV in my room. And it was the greatest thing. It was like the first time it was broadcast. It was like the craziest thing. Anyway, sorry, everybody. I just needed to touch on Empire and
nostalgia.
Hence the whole theme of the show, nostalgia. Very powerful if you want to make a living in this business. If you could tap into any nostalgia, which is just another word for niche, but niche mixed with nostalgia is very powerful. Because I think you would agree with me on this. It connects to you emotionally. And when you connect emotionally to something, it'll cut through any marketing budget. Whatever, you could be throwing $100 million worth of ads to watch the next Aquaman. And don't get me wrong, I like the first Aquaman, but like I'll put Aquaman 2 on because I want to watch the last blockbuster, because I want to go back to that emotion again. And that's so powerful.
If Yeah, but if you were one of those kids who growing up, Aquaman was your favorite comic book,
the trailer
could be 1 second of a picture of a fish and you would be there day one, you know, the special IMAX extra expensive ticket.
Whatever it is.
Because of that nostalgia. So, and we see that all the time. Like, they know when they make an Avengers movie, it's weird that they spend so much on marketing because they really, really don't have to because of the built-in nostalgia. Because I grew up reading Spider-Man comics, I'm going to watch whatever movie you make with Spider-Man in it, and I'm not going to like some of them, but I'm still going to be there day one, and you're going to get my ticket money. So.
And now I think also that with the Avengers specifically, they've built in a decade plus of nostalgia. Like, so Robert Downey's Iron Man
right.
is nostalgia now. Like
right.
Chris Evans is Captain America, because they're not quote unquote doing it anymore. I think I just heard that Chris Evans might come back for a little bit. Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that Chris Evans signed to come back to do a few. And I think even Robert said, all right, give me another $70 million. I'll come back. he might come back. But there's nostalgia now for those early movies as well. And we're living in, because we've never has there been a series that was a decade old and you're just so nostalgic with those characters? And we've seen a lot of Robert Downey as Iron Man over the last 10 years.
I think James Bond is the only other one. Yeah. And then Star Wars when it came back.
Right.
You know, like when, you know, no Mandalorian spoilers, but the last scene of the thing, when that happens, mm-hmm. I mean, that's...
Oh, that's... That is such a...
That's the nostalgia.
That was such a blatant... Oh my God. So, and I swear, did you see the reaction videos online of grown ass men like us just sitting there, and the daughters and their young, like teenage daughters are filming their dad losing their collective shit, crying at that scene in Mandalorian. I was here like this, like, it was just weirdest. Yeah. Weirdest thing I'd ever experienced, because I was, thank God, alone when I was watching it, and I was just acting like a child again. It was just such a amazing thing that they've done with that show. Guys, I'm sorry, we have gone off the tracks. Back to the show. Two other films you love. Okay.
Great. The other one is Back to the Future Part 2 mm-hmm. from a trilogy. And it's not everybody's favorite of the trilogy, but it's mine. I love it. I think you can't have Back to the Future without hoverboards. So it's the first one that has that.
And it's obviously almost as accurate of predictions as The Simpsons for the future. There were so many things they got right. They got so many things right about the future. Back to the Future too was pretty amazing. And I don't know if you saw that. You probably have, but the fake documentary or the fake news story about the hoverboards with Robert Zemeckis talking about, like, yeah, they've been hiding this technology.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, and they're just letting us use it now. And it's really real. That whole thing was pretty amazing.
Viral marketing at the time. I was a little kid when that came out, and an older brother, 10 years older. And we lived in a small town in Oregon. And it was about an hour to get into town. We drive into town once a week, right, for shopping. And we were going to Toys R Us, and we had seen that on TV. And my brother had me convinced that when we got to Toys R Us, there were going to be hoverboards. And, you know, the whole thing, I thought, you know, it's going to be, they're real. They're going to be, they just released them. They're in the store. And I'm like 9 years old, and he's totally got me convinced. And we got there, and, you know, he pulled the switcheroo of like, oh no, government says they're too dangerous. We can't have them. They're real, but the government says, and I probably cried all the way home. But then I went back to elementary school, like convinced that they were real, and told all the other kids that they were real. And it was years before anybody corrected me and was like, you know, that was just marketing.
That's marketing, sir. Marketing. Yes.
Yeah. Well, good marketing.
It worked. And third movie.
The third movie is an often overlooked gem. We talked a bit about Tom Hanks earlier, but my all-time favorite movie that's not part of a trilogy is That Thing You Do, the Tom Hanks classic from 1996 about the one-hit wonder band, The Wonders.
That was his directorial debut, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't it?
It might be. I know he directed, acts in it, and wrote some of the songs.
I think that was like the first time that he kind of jumped into the director's seat. He wanted to do something cool. I remember that. Yeah, it's a great film. A great soundtrack.
It's great.
Great.
It's great. Always makes me smile. It's one of those, if it's on TV, I'll watch it even though I have it on VHS, DVD, and Blu-ray. I'll watch it on and TV too.
Of course. And Beta, of course, Betamax or something.
Oh, I wish.
And where can people find more about you, your work, where to get VHSs and things like that?
Yeah. So my company is called Pop Motion Pictures. That's my production company, popmotionpictures.com. Links to all the movies. But if you want to go straight to The Last Blockbuster, you can find it on Netflix or go to lastblockbustermovie.com to find, you know, the DVDs and the VHSs and the t-shirts and all that stuff they have at the store.
Yeah. And is the lastblockbuster.com that's for the store or is it just for the movie?
No, we link to the store for merch. The store is bendblockbuster.com. It's weird. It's, you know, we're both on all the social media platforms. So you got to, one, we try to put the word movie in all our accounts. So, you know, one's the documentary and one's the store. They do a pretty good job with social media considering they're an outdated, video rental store, but they're on the TikTok just like we are. And, yeah, you know, if you Google The Last Blockbuster, you'll find both the movie and the store.
Taylor, man, thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you for making this movie because it took me down memory. I wish you could give me the smell-o-vision. I wish you could, like when we watch it, I could smell it in it. Oh, look at that. Oh, hold on.
Just listen for the people.
Oh, stop
that
it.
That sound, right?
Oh, stop. Oh, the click. Oh, my
VHS
God.
VHS tape, man. That's the closest I can do for a smell for you. But I do tell people if you order our DVD from the store, it's shipped from the store. So, you know, if you're not worried about COVID, when you open that package, you take a deep breath and it smells like Blockbuster in there.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Taylor, man, thanks again for being on the show, man. I appreciate it, brother.
Thanks for having me.
Taylor, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and taking us back down nostalgia lane with video stores, that click that I wish we could smell the VHS inside the box. But thank you so much, my friend. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/457. And again, if you have not seen The Last Blockbuster, do yourself a favor, go to Netflix and watch it right now. Thank you guys so much for listening. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.